members of parliament, these are politicians in general, but these are private entrepreneurs, right? That are employees in the state administration, right? So you have this classical Central European set of values where the free professions are at the very top and everything else is at the very bottom. Okay, so that was... Yes, what kind of profession? The question was, let's see. Right, they will ask what kind of professions you think have the highest social status or something along those lines. These are.
That's where we belong. We should all move to Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely, this is our place. Yes. okay. Now, so that's. Okay, that is European story. Let me make four analytical observations. Now, the first issue, and I think this goes back to the heart of our discussion today. The first issue is about defining middle class. And I think that the most important here is the distinction. You know, the economists are doing this silly game, trying to solve the problem whether middle class is between $12 and $50 or between $2 and $13, and is it middle level income in Italy and something of that sort. I mean, this is complete nonsense, right? Because, you know, we are not talking about aggregates. We are talking about groups. And this goes back to what Atul mentioned, the old Marxist debates and whether we are talking about classes for itself, classes for themselves, and so on and so on. Now, everyone almost mentioned today names like Weber, Bourdieu, Foucault. I think this is the analytical route we should go. Right, the types of capital, the identifications, identities, genealogies of value systems, and so on, so on. That's very important, and I think this is something which we should keep in mind. Now, the second important thing is understanding the sectoral composition of the middle class, and I think this is critical issue because these are fragmenting social entities. And we have this fragmentation going at least in four different dimensions. So first of all, are the different types of capital in Bourdieu sense, right? So how much cultural capital you have, what's the difference between economic, political, social, and so on. You know, I don't have to tell you the story. Now, the second differentiation is relation to the state. And I think you have different segments of middle class in different relations to the state in different societies. The third distinction are the organizational vehicles of the middle class. And I think this is important. We haven't mentioned that enough today because the expression, the behavior goes through organizations, right? So, you know, workers are organizing trade unions, and that's very recognizable. Now, are professional organizations only a way in which middle class is organized, or NGOs, and so on, so on. So that's very important. The fourth important dimension is are different transnational networks, right? Because it's a very interesting story with both transnational capital and transnational civil society, how new different segments of middle class are produced in those countries, and what's the relationship between those externally produced segments of middle class and internal political situation, right? So I think that this is important thing. Now, one more point. Now, Atul once had this wonderful idea of followers' democracies, and I think that we should really start thinking about follower middle classes. Because the contemporary middle classes are developing in very different context, and we could characterize this context by a few very simple things. So first of all, these are the middle classes after democracy, and if it's not democracy, at least it's competitive authoritarianism. That changes the rules of the game in very significant way. Right, so that's question number one. Now, the issue number two is that these middle classes are emerging in the context of redistributive states, with a very powerful welfare agenda, for example, and very powerful welfare policies. Again, this changes the game in quite dramatic way vis-a-vis, you know, the older modernization project. Now, the third issue is that this middle class is emerging in the context of mass consumer society. Now, when you read about, you know, 18th century England, the thing was that it was difficult to get stuff, right? You had to have a lot of money to get stuff. Now it's very easy to get stuff. It may be not, you know, the original Armani, but it may be fake Armani. It looks the same. You can get the stuff. So, you know, this changes the status game in a very powerful way. But also what is, and this is the second thought about consumption. No one mentioned this today. You think about the American middle class and West European middle class, they emerge in the context of mass consumption, right? The stories about everyone who wanted to have exactly the same house and that car in the loan and everything. Now, the mass consumption is changing today in a very dramatic way. It's moving to the niche consumptions. There is only mass consumption in terms of quantity, but not in quality, right? The consumption of different groups and segments of the population is being ghettoized in such a way that there is no sort of linkages between consumption of different groups. And that sort of creates completely new situation for the middle class. And final point I want to make about this is that middle class now emerges in the context of global liberalization, which changes the rules of the game in such a way that it creates a lot of exit options for members of the middle class, right? And that's, you know, and this is one of the reasons why we see the depoliticization process of the middle class, right? So among others, I can talk about this later, among the others, the multiple exit options are making middle class less political. Right? And I think that this will go back to my initial point that if this is true, right, if these new middle classes are developing in so many different ways than the old ones, and if the new context is so much different, and there are so many exit options, this middle class is going to be less political, and Eastern Europe is the last middle class revolution we've seen. Okay, thank you. Sorry for this going over time.
Well, I think, you know, usually by the end of the day, you begin to flag. But these two presentations sort of revived our energies in a tremendous way.
It's not good for us. Then you want to ask the question.
I know. I was just a couple of questions to each of you, just to start us off. I guess I was struck by, Deborah, what you were saying about China, because I suppose more in contrast with what I think about India, and it's interesting to see if Atul and Patrick have anything to say to that. I mean, one is it's striking that communist China, the inequalities, Gini's are much higher compared to India. So India actually, surprisingly, has actually changed just modestly. You know, the Gini, you know, has gone up from about 0.33 to 0.34, 0.35 over the past 20 years. And at least as it's measured. I mean, the general sense is it's probably higher, but at least when you measure it, and in 1980 when we have these numbers for China is lower than India, and now China is much higher. The second is the overlap between tech technocrats and the political apparatus, which is the party in China, which your evidence is quite striking that it's actually, the overlap is quite strong.
Well,
or it's almost.
It was complete until this. That's what we're interested in now, is to what extent is it pulling apart.
And in India, it's interesting that the social basis of those who've gone, especially in the private sector and those in the state apparatus, is actually there's much more bifurcation. It's the lower castes who've gradually gone in the state, and the upper castes have been exiting to the private sector or outside the country. So in this case, the overlap in the Indian case is relatively much less, whereas in the 40s and 50s, the upper caste did control the state, but now they are in business, the lower caste. And you see it in the occupation choices of those who were in the senior civil service, army officers, generals. They are no longer going to the state for jobs. They are undoubtedly going out. So in that case, the overlap is much. And of course, if you end up with this provocative point about like religion as a potential source of or sort of locus of politics. Now, of course, if you work on India, I mean, that's not a big deal, you know. So, I mean, I could virtually take from your thing and saying, you know, maybe India might be more stable than China. You know, it's used to dealing with religion and politics. You know, it sort of comes and goes. It's not that unequal, you know, that much. And, you know, you don't have a concentration of power of all of this in one group as in the Communist Party, you know, politics, technocrats, all of that in one. And I just sort of throw it out and just see what others might have to say on that. Your point, you know, you made this point sort of earlier about when you talk of the exit option. And transnationalism, that de-territorialization, does it lead to depoliticization? And in some ways, it has echoes of the Hirschmanian sort of exit and voice. You know, if you exit, you don't want to exercise voice. I suppose, you know, this is sort of the book I've just finished on international migration, and I'm arguing actually in some cases it can reinforce voice. You know, if you look at the Indian migrants who come here, they do extremely well in Silicon Valley and so on. They've physically exited, obviously. But, you know, the financial capital and symbolic capital of being successful in Silicon Valley actually gives them and has given them voice much more than if they had not left. So I just want to sort of raise the question under what, is it the case, necessarily the case, that exit necessarily leads to a loss of voice in this transnational thing, where by going abroad you can acquire not just financial capital, but also symbolic capital? And I'll just sort of open it up to others. Eva?
This is a question for Jay Gorshin. It's just to reveal my utter ignorance. I am so surprised to hear you call the regime changes in Eastern Europe as middle class revolutions. And I was under the impression that, in fact, the regime change that we saw, Poland aside, was largely revolution from above, but in the sense that the state from above just disintegrated for all sorts of confluence of international and domestic factors, structural factors, and that it was not a consequence of collective mobilization from below, unseeming the regimes. Have I got it totally wrong?
That's a good opening.
Just,
I think
we take a few
questions
and then we go.
So I wanted to follow up on this issue of consumption and distinction among the middle class. And I'm struck by a number of things you said, Gavarsh, but I wanted to push you on this point a little bit, that to the extent that the communist revolution was destroyed existing status hierarchies, people have this need. I think a lot of identity literature shows that people have need to make distinctions. Humans in society to make distinctions all the time, and they, if they don't have something objective to make distinctions, they come up with things. So distinctions are all around in all kinds of identity. And so it's an interesting moment of a real destruction of existing status hierarchies, say in Russia or Eastern Europe, in a way that arguably has not happened in remotely close to say in India. So one question is, what about this in China? I don't know hardly anything about China, work on Russia, but so that's one question is, to what extent has the communist revolution or the communist transformation actually destroyed pre-existing status hierarchies, or to what extent have they been mapped on in different ways? That's one question. But on the consumption side, and the homogenization of taste, I wonder if we're missing something without kind of going a little bit more into consumption. And that, it seemed to me in the socialist period, people spent a lot of time within the confines of socialism still trying to make distinctions. So, okay, there's five lamps available, but one is a little bit less available. So you're going to look all over the city just to have that one lamp that's a little bit different than all the lamps everybody else has. So you would spend an inordinate amount of time ostensibly chasing after a lamp, but not because you need a light, because there's plenty of lamps around. But you want a special light that's not quite like everybody else's lamp, because you're so forced to look like everybody and do what everybody's doing, that this seeming consumerism really is masking. They're not looking for lamps. They have electricity. They're looking for ways to set themselves aside, apart from their neighbors. And I think kind of, this is just anecdotally speaking, mainly because of Russia, that to me a striking transformation after the end of the Soviet Union is this huge proliferation of distinctive groups, heavy metalers. People finally have this ability to express themselves, the self-expression in all kinds of different ways, even cliched ways, but still just need to express themselves. And so instead of just wanting washing machines or VCRs, they want a specific brand, or it was clothing in particular. Like the high-end stores in Moscow, I would always joke that there's a Jimmy Choo store in Moscow, but not in Boston. You know? That these stores, why? Because people in Moscow aren't content to just have any pair of shoes. They need to have a specific pair of shoes. So it's not the shoes per se. It's showing that I am somebody who knows what are the fashionable shoes in the world, not just in my country. So part of it is information and cultural capital, I guess I would say. That, so it's not just the consumer thing, but it's these consumer goods are kind of a mask for information and other ways to just set yourself aside. So that, I guess I would just throw into this mix of consumerism as, or consumption and distinction. Is it really the goods per se, the objective good task that they fulfill, or is it something more?
I think
so. It's the end of the day, and I have a slogan: servants, not genies. And I want to try to explain that. You know, every time I go to a conference in Latin America, they're almost enough. And this doesn't include present company, but they're almost always. They love to say Latin America is the most unequal place in the world, and they trot out the genie, which is six or whatever. Of course, South Africa is six as well. I always say to them, you should go to India. I mean, you know, I don't care what the genie is in India, and it's three something. A, there's a huge measurement problem. I think most economists think it's probably mismeasured. But if we're serious about inequality, we have to recognize that it's more than genies, right? I mean, when you have the kind of perverse, durable, systematic forms of social exclusion and invisibility, you know, the caste systems, certain gender exclusions, you know, we have to recognize that's the real form of inequality. And I want to say servants, not genies, and take up Raka's call for using servants as a much better index of real sociological inequality than genies, because it does strike me that, you know, where you have high percentage of servants, that's ultimately a manifestation of deeply ingrained forms of support in public. But having said that, I thought Deborah's genie data was fantastic and very telling. And I'd like to push two comparative points here, because I think both presentations are really fantastic and set up a natural set of comparisons. One has to do with the whole state nobility argument. So clearly these are post-communist societies or societies where, precisely because capital in the traditional sense didn't matter as much, they become sort of perfect places to study Bourdieu and accounts of inequality, right? It's the cultural capital that really mattered. And I'm reminded of a study, I forget the name of the person who did it, but it was a 30-country study. And usually I don't like these sort of large end things, but when they have results that I like them. It's a great result. It was looking at educational outcomes, and they threw everything into the models. And the one measure that predicted educational outcome the most was the number of books in your parents' house. Right? And it wasn't everything, it was the number of books. I think the cutoff was 500. And the interesting thing is when they ranked the countries that had the strongest association between books and educational outcomes were the Eastern European countries, China, and France. Not surprising, right? So I'd love to hear you just comment a little bit more about just how deeply salient cultural capital is in that sense. And then the second point, comparative point, is about a middle class politics. So in Eastern Europe, the middle class becomes this not quite revolutionary, but at least transformative social agent. In China, it doesn't. So the question is, why? Is it because of the timing of the economic transitions and the more successful way in which China used state capacities to manage that transition and reduce that expectations gap? And one other quick comparative comment. I don't think Eastern Europe's that unique. I think the middle classes in Brazil and South Africa also play quite instrumental roles, aligning with other subordinate group actors and pushing democratization.
Why don't we sort of take this round, and then we'll have another.
We have a lot of issues. I very exciting ones. Now with Gini, I think it's not what you have now. It's a takeoff point, right? I think India is behind the curve when you compare this to China. Right, because you know, in India you will have this dramatic start of in let's say 5-6 years when the global recession is over and all the industries will move from China to India and you will have this new elephant emerging and so on. So I think you know now it's probably the moment where it's very difficult to say what would be the impact of inequalities regardless of the fact whether they are real or how they are measured and so on and so on. Relationship between middle class and the state. I think this is not an accident that the two most reformist countries in Eastern Europe were Poland and Hungary, which had quite significant segments of the middle class outside the servitude of the state. And I think that 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 was the starting point. But then you will see in the process of development, something which David Stark once called the spontaneous privatization, right? So, you know, the state service class moving to the private sector, and I think this is interesting, and this is probably contrast to India, where you have those established hierarchies and sort of you know trajectories of different segments of the middle class, which have been there for a long period of time. Now the revolution in Eastern Europe, of course, it's a combination of sort of from above and from below, and I think but the question is sort of what's the nature of the early risers in this sort of cycle of revolutionary movements, and what are the diffusion mechanisms in it, right? So I think that you know Poland did the work for Central Europe. So you could say that because of that, most of the revolutions are the sort of outcome of the from below movement, and ethnic revolts did the trick in the former Soviet Union. So, right, Mike Basinger is making this point in a very very powerful way that this is sort of from below. So I think yes, it's a tricky issue and a very complicated one. One point. About consumption. Now, the point that I was trying to make about consumption is that we have sort of movement from mass consumption to parcelization of mass consumption. And I think this is important. There's wonderful literature on this in history and in anthropology. So consumption is a big thing. And I'm very dilettante. So I'm not pretending that I know that stuff. Now, under the state socialism, of course, the status hierarchies were recreated over and over again. And I think, you know, when the Communist Party decided that not everyone needs to have exactly the same clothes and the same haircut that you can allow some diversity, then you have the hybridization of the new status hierarchy. And this hybridization included three different elements. So first of all, it was the restoration of the old traditions, right? So every intellectual in Russia after a certain point wanted to have a dacha, because, you know, Pushkin and all, everyone had a dacha, so we, you know, that's what the normal human being who writes book deserves. Right? So there's this big, powerful historical recreation of some status hierarchies on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, because of the openness to the West, people noticed, how people live across the Cold War border. So the second element are those sort of, very funny images of the consumption in the West and elements of it so integrated with that old tradition. And finally, you know, the hard line of the Communist Party, which says, well, you know, everyone deserves a certain size of apartment and this. So yes, you know, there was a lot of showing off. What kind of books did you have on your shelves? Played tremendous role. You know, I remember my father had this gigantic collection of books, and once the peasant from the collector farm delivered potatoes to our house for the winter, and he looked at this book and asked my father, "Did you read all those books?" And I said, "Of course. Can I kiss your hand?" He said, "You know, this is the recreation of the old status hierarchy. You have, you know, someone who could read so many books. You know, this is an unbelievable person, right?" So, yeah, it's very interesting.
To Deborah.
Oh, I guess
all
the big question.
Out.
Yeah, we could listen to him all day. Whether India is politically more stable than China, I mean. That could be a conference. The more narrow question, based on what the small examples I was giving, is about particularly the role of these professional and technocratic pieces, whether they will be more, or what, you know, what role they will play in this near-term future. And it's a big question. I mean, I really don't know. It's something that I'm watching, looking backward, which is what people, you know, they ask you. They have been remarkably uncritical and willing to make their lives better. But beneath the surface, you know, a great deal is going on. It's an incredibly exciting time. So I think at one level, of course, India is a more developed polity. There are so many more institutions and parties. I mean, and a history of dealing with things politically. And China doesn't have that, right? It's still in a mobilization mode. And that's a very fragile, in a way. It can be very strong, and the coercive powers can be impressive. But the tensile strength is much less. I mean, that's the big question. No answer. But the smaller question you ask about exit, does exit mean the loss of voice? And you gave the example of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. There is absolutely the comparable situation in China. Many people who have exited, whether they're artists who then went back and played the big role in the Olympics. There are many scientists who have gone back. There are people in finance who have gone back. So I think there's something quite comparable. Whereas though there's those who are still politically more vulnerable or seen as extremists, for them exit has been the loss of voice domestically, although they haven't lost their voice internationally. So I think it's a very wonderful question to which I can't possibly have an answer. on whether the communist revolution destroyed the pre-existing status hierarchies. The communist revolution worked very, very hard to do that. It lasted about 30 years, and the vehicle of class struggle was developed to a very high level in China. Every single person had a class label, and that class label determined your life chances, and the struggles came through rather often, if we think about, you know, it's a very compressed historical period. And because it was compressed, and because of the brutality with which those class struggles were imposed, people actually have come back very quickly with an alternative, right? And one of the things that Deng Xiaoping said in 1980, which was very early in the reform period, was, we're finished with class labels, we're finished with class struggle. And they were erased from dossiers. Those of us who, you know, had spent our graduate lives sorting through that and doing the interviews and were, wow, something that had been so important was erased. And of course, you can't imagine that. But if you're talking about these other ways, and the example that Gregor just did about kissing your hand and the sense of nobility and what that meant, of course, people in China remember quite clearly what had been considered high status. But China is a society that is built on not just the myth, but of reality of a meritocracy through the exams. And we can study it. We can say certainly people who have books in the house, et cetera, are going to succeed better. But if we look at marriage, as a sociologist, you know, at intermarriage, the Chinese are historically were really quite open to the son of the shepherd or the cowherder who made it through the exams, marrying the daughter of the noble. This was, you know, not the noble, but the rich man. So it is historically a very open society in terms of status hierarchies. And the Confucian virtuocracy type of hierarchies really are something that you can participate in within one generation. And I'm not saying there aren't old families and there aren't these kinds of markers that people take seriously, but in comparative perspective, what's striking about China is the degree to which one can invent oneself in your own lifetime. And so that, you know, no family goes five generations. So it's, might say, three generations up and three generations back to poverty. That's sort of the pre-communist myth. And on this question of cultural capital, we have this, a couple of articles that we used from our household interviews. It really is not quite a survey. I mean, it's structured as a survey, but the data is more like what you would get in a house, in a more qualitative, I would say, project. We looked at the reading habits and we looked at the associational activities. What we found, this is the last thing I'll say, which was the technocrats, that the Communist Party members had very high cultural capital, which actually didn't surprise us since these were the people who had access to, in many cases, the opportunity to read. They were rewarded for reading. And the Communist Party has evolved. I mean, it was created by intellectuals. The leadership has been very high status and background. And there's not a contradiction between having political capital and having cultural capital.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for the
panel.
Great having you here. I just want to I have a question that I've been thinking about in relation to globalization and the middle class, and whether or not that explains why the middle class is going to be depoliticized if you're made of disempowered. Depoliticized because it has multiple exit options. And I guess my question is this. I believe that the globalization has depoliticized the middle class, but through a different mechanism, perhaps. And I hope it doesn't come up as provocative, but I'm going to put it out there. Which is basically, we're missing the geopolitics behind globalization. You know, globalization is about a system of international trade and whatnot that really requires specific type of relationships and domestic stability, whether or not the country is authoritarian or democratic. So, for example, China, or in many cases in the Arab world, And if you're a middle class or aspiring middle class, or what's termed the global middle class, you become more embedded not only in the state structures, but also now the global structures that render you more or less disempowered, right? So it's not only that, even if you revolt against the state, you still have to contend with the international order. So in other words, that the global middle class now is really caught in this double wedge or duality of hierarchical relations, which is really going to render it impotent. So I agree that maybe Eastern Europe is the last middle class revolution, but that it's not because now you have globalization and all these exit options and things look rosier for the middle class. It's because actually things look that much worse for the middle class in terms of middle class economy.
You're gay.
Thank you. Great panel. There's a lot of fine minds in this room. It's wonderful to listen to all of you. One question for Deborah and one for Shigeru, since I have
you.
You know, this China inequality stuff, I've been looking at some data also. If one looks at China's inequality not through Gini, and I think there was some support in your own data for what I'm going to say, look at top 20% as a ratio of bottom 20% or the other way around, sorry.
Whatever, yeah.
But basically, not very narrow or the whole Gini trying to map the entire picture. Then China, even though still quite unequal, probably the most unequal of Asian countries, is still below nearly all of Latin America. So only Malaysia is more unequal in Asia compared to China. So some of it is measurement, and some, you know, sort of, it still has become enormously unequal. I don't have any doubt there. But through Gini, it's beginning to look like approaching Brazil, which I think is not quite accurate. So I would like your reflections on this, if this 2020 measurement, which I'm using, are bad or for some reason I should not be using, etc. From my own work. Gregor's analysis, I want to go back to Eva's question. You know, calling these middle class revolutions, you know, who causes the revolution and who benefits from the revolution are always different things. There's no doubt you're right that these are the people who are now buying televisions. You know, so these are the people who benefit. But to sort of, I think it's rewriting the history too much to call these middle class revolutions. So let's just talk about Poland for a minute, right? You mentioned solidarity. Solidarity is born and matures where? In a Paul Lenin shipyard. These were workers. And this is in Gdansk. Now, maybe it was born somewhere. I shouldn't get talk about Poland with you.
But especially because he was with the movement.
I was there.
I was there also as an external observer. All right? So I will just push my little bit of knowledge about as far as I can. Here's, you know, sort of impressionistically speaking, never having studied the subject, it struck me that Warsaw was way behind in understanding what was happening in Gdansk. Every time we went up north, intellectuals from the Academy of Social Sciences were speculating what was going on inside. And they were so excited moving to Gdansk to get a sense of what was happening. So the center of gravity was not with the middle classes. They were with a variety of working classes, variety of ship workers, and sort of not in the center, but in the periphery. So that's one observation. And second, there was a type of euphoria in Poland at that time, which defies all analysis, which says these were ordinary people wanting ordinary things, which was the thrust of your comment. There was a sense, which was unreal, that we can do anything. And I would ask these intellectuals or shipyard workers, well, what about this bear next door? What's going to happen? You guys keep pushing. And there was this sense, we can take them on, or they won't come in. And it was almost something religious, and which created power in and of itself. It was no ordinary revolt of the middle classes wanting ordinary things. It was a revolt of nearly euphoric, religious, crazed people who created enormous power as a result of that euphoria. and therefore succeeded against enormous odds. You know, so if this is all based on 2 weeks at that time, you know, before and so on. But if this has any merit, I would like to understand why you want to paint the picture as utterly normal middle classes wanting normal things and therefore communists can't.
Just to rephrase his point, he's basically asking, are Poles crazy?
Yes.
Those are such great questions. These last two particularly, I'm almost reluctant to ask my question, but it's a comment that I think builds on these a little bit. One, I really, both wonderful presentations, and I really appreciated Deborah's question at the end, what are the cross-caste class alliances? And it brings us back to politics. Mm-hmm. With the political potential for change in the future, what do we expect to see? And I'm a little bit inspired by Shigori's use of the word postmodern. I'm thinking to bring these things together. And I want to repose a question to you folks and all of us, is where are the cross-class alliances with political potential to change the future? I thought of it so much looking at the statistics on China. It's still 50% rural. India is still 50% rural. We can't be talking about classes and cross-class alliances in the kind of free-floating national spaces, because all the major revolutions or changes or whatever, we can go back to Tilian Vendée, we can think about Gdansk. Where did these things happen with the classes they happened? I think we can't separate them out. And so then the thing that I'm struggling with here and thinking about the contemporary period of the newly emerging economies is it city versus countryside? Again, I'm interested in that. Is it big cities or is it medium-sized cities? I know in India now the medium-sized cities are growing in a crazy fashion. There's politics in place making the big ones, not the medium-sized ones. Or, to put it another way, not just... And are these going to be local struggles, or are they going to be national? This is where the postmodern comes in. Are people going to struggle around national projects anymore, or are they going to be local projects, or are they going to be transnational projects? And so it's really an issue about scale and sovereignty. And you also mentioned the transnational networks, the voice question. I think that's really an important part of this. This reflection, which is, are people going to be struggling around national political projects anymore, is another way to say it. And what are the alternatives? So that's another form of the where question. Where are these changes going to be happening?
If we'll take like one last one, Lenoa. Okay.
I've got to be very, very brief because it is a little good with space and time, so I'm quite humbled by this wonderful discussion. I have some questions on China, and then the exit thing, because it's even more as well. There are some people who think now China is at a crossroad where, because of the financial crisis, China has become made aware even more than ever before that its export-led growth needs to be counterbalanced by domestic demand-driven growth. Because its external market is becoming too volatile and vulnerable. And this demand-driven growth means actually more or less middle-class consumption, big style, which takes it back to the social contract issue. I'll make you consume, I'll allow you, I'll give you all the freedom, but please, you know, the limit is politics, just stay out as much as you can. My question to you would be, can China afford to have that controlled experiment of expanding its middle class's purchasing power, so to speak, so that it becomes, among other things, a driver of China's growth in the future, and suppress the political desire to be part of the game if you are not already part of the game. Given the fact that there are two very interesting things that we observe when we interact with China on the ground as developing Asians, two things come very clear to mind. Number one, there is an interesting competition culture in China nowadays between the different provinces, and the government is coming up with these benchmarks of good governance, trying to array themselves. hardships in the provinces, yet grading them and scoring them on the good governance at the same time. How much of that comes into play from your understanding of the middle class as being the, I mean, we talk about middle class basically when I'm explaining all this. And the second thing is the whole issue of land grabbing in China in the name of investment, in the name of industrial zoning, in the name of, again, the province is trying to score better on the governance, spectrum. And that creates tensions between different middle class capital for ownership and between them and the poorer tenants and peasants in North Africa, especially in the wealthy countryside. I'd like your sense of that political dynamism taking place in China right now. And finally, on the exit thing, besides your point about exit actually creating voice, I'd rather say, it depends, watch out and be careful, it depends on two things. When you exited, where did you go? If you went to Saudi Arabia, you're coming back with a very conservative voice, thank you very much. And it depends on the political economy of your country, where is it taking you back in, and the accountability mechanisms in your country as well. So let's not be very...
I think we are a bit late. So Debra, why don't you start us off, and we'll just spend a few minutes each.
Very, very briefly, there are wonderful questions, many more than I could possibly handle any day, but especially not at 5 o'clock. On the inequality piece, I think we all in this room know that you can create genies out of anything. Income data is remarkably unreliable. If you're just on the ground, moving through China, the inequalities are in your face, and they're growing. So that's why the wealth issue, the housing issue, the medical care, whatever. But particularly in the last 5 years, the leadership has been very, very committed. They are very concerned about genies. I mean, you go to China, people, when I talk about genies, people all know what you're talking about. And they're very worried about it. So that's the idea, is inequality is bad. This is not where China wants to go. And if we look at the education outcomes and the health outcomes, on one hand, the gap has grown. On the other hand, they still have raised the bottom. And they have created greater security for many people, even as the gap, as you measure it, grows higher. So this 20% to 20%, certainly that's something we do with all different kinds of outcomes. And the issue also then becomes this intergenerational one. How do younger people feel? And if they feel that more doors are open, if they feel that the educational opportunities have increased, if they feel that the future will be better, and they do feel the future will be better, survey after survey, almost nobody is discouraged. It's very hard to find a really discouraged worker in China. It's very hard to find a really discouraged young person in the countryside our survey is in the countryside, and we have this area which was supposedly a poverty area, deep poverty, and that's where we did our survey work, and we returned to that area. Each time, it's better. So that's the drift. And I haven't been back in 12 months. Next week I leave, so maybe things are going to be very different. But from the indirect readings, I don't think so. So, they've made these investments in human capital that are really paying off. They are very close to having universalized 9 years of education. And 9 years of education in China is very impressive, what they have accomplished. And so while people can be frustrated and people can be angry and they can talk about corruption, the sense across different economic strata across the country is that we are going in the right direction. We are not going backwards. We are not going to where we were before. So there isn't that. There's an alternative. What's happening seems to be working, and so you don't break what's not broken. That said, there are all kinds of critical views. And on this the local versus the center or the regional competition, if we look at elite politics, the kind of thing that you're talking about with these governance ranks, people are moved around, so if you do well, then you move around. So it's not like it's an entrenched Guangdong or Jiangsu or Zhejiang group that's three generations or two generations or even 20 years. The idea is you make good there, and if you're at the upper level, then you get transferred someplace else. And that's how these rankings are being used. And in generally, they're actually more successful than many people thought they were. That said, there's lots of tensions, and I would be a fool if I were to try to say, you know, predict anything. But the mood is leading up to the Olympics, after the Olympics, is we've really done well. We have a place at the table, and we are a great nation. And then that's the other piece, is this is a huge nation with the longest history of being a coherent state. And there are people on the edges, you know, the Tibetans, are they part of it, are they not part of it? And Xinjiang, you know, we can look at the areas around the edge and how long have they been part of this nation state. But it really functions for a very long time like that, so that it's very hard to compare it to other parts of the world, which are much more, they're newer states and they're smaller states, and they haven't done as well by delivering the goods to the people. At this moment, you know, the government's doing a pretty good job, and that's how people feel about it. So on this question about the depoliticized middle class, I don't talk about the middle class. I really like to specify who I'm talking about. In this presentation, I really talked about that 9%, the 9th percentile, who are these college-educated professional technocrats, professional and managers. And they are increasingly, their majority are in the private sector now, although a significant third are still in the public sector. There are good jobs in the public sector, whether it's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the EPA. There are lots of forward-thinking, exciting 45-year-old party members who would like China to be different. But that doesn't mean they want party politics. They just want better, cleaner government. They want a better judiciary. Their main focus is to make the laws that are on the books enforceable. And if they could do that, most people would feel that the revolution had been a success, and it's not easy. But that's where I would say the energies of that slice are going. That's their focus on politics and not on elections. If we look at other cases, and this urban-rural split is huge, this migration, the country is now more in the cities than in the countryside. The countryside is industrialized, large parts of it. This revolution, the cell phone revolution, has brought things much closer together. That, you know, the isolation that was even there 5 years ago is much, much less, so that people are physically moving long distances. They're in contact across long distances. That rural-urban divide is changing as we speak. And the last thing is about the land, taking it. It's a huge issue, this, quote, land grabbing, because all land is owned collectively. And in the cities, this means by the city government. And there's enormous, people have made enormous profits, and there is enormous corruption. And it's a source of a lot of judicial activity and political anger. But it tends to be contained. It doesn't doesn't reduce regime legitimacy.
Thank you. Mr. Jaggers?
Okay. Let me briefly acknowledge three points. The first is the questions about inequalities. I think we can measure inequality in many different ways. We really need to keep in mind that there is different tolerance for inequality in different societies, and I think that the real understanding should sort of grab that relationship. The new moral modernizing project, this is a very important issue, and I think that the future is European Union, that you will not have, then, except for India and Russia and China, you will not have a national modernizing project. You will have either transnational or local or regional crossing national boundaries. Patrick's point about cultural capital, Bourdieu is interested in reproduction. So if we want to apply his categories to transformation, we have to think about this a little bit more. That's one thing. And then, of course, it's the question of different combinations in different societies and so on. So that's very exciting. Two more sentences about exit options. I think I didn't have enough time really to explore that issue, but I think that we, when I said multiple exit options, I meant both internal and external, right? So when you think about internal exit options, when you get a job in a foreign-funded NGO, this is internal exit. And you know, in many places, that foreign NGO will tell you, keep away from politics, because our main thing is service for poor people. And, you know, I've read this wonderful work on Bangladesh, which exactly what is going on, that elite sort of Bangladeshi middle class withdraws from politics because, you know, the jobs they have with the foreign-funded NGOs sort of keeps them on the margin of participating in politics. The same will be with the foreign business. The investment firms don't really want to sort of, you know, risk being involved in local politics. So, but then, of course, is the emigration option. And that, of course, is the immigration of, the option of moving to the informal sector in a variety of ways, right? So withdrawing from formal politics in this way. And diaspora story, of course, I think she was right that diasporas usually support the most horrible political causes you can imagine. It's either religion, it's nationalism, and all those horrible things. So from that point of view, you know, that voice is exactly the kind of voice you don't want to have in your national politics.
But it is voice.
Then I have time to say two more sentences about solidarity movement.
Yeah.
This is great. You know, when I was in the Gdańsk shipyard, there was a ban on alcohol imposed by the city government when the strike started in the city, and then imposed by the striking committee in the shipyard as well. But then, of course, you have entrepreneurs around, and there was this nice lady who just smuggled two bottles of vodka to the shipyard, and of course she was caught by the workers' guard, and there was this gigantic scene on the platform, you know, across from the main entry, where Valença said, "Okay, here it is. There is this horrible woman who was trying to break our rules and brought this alcohol to the shipyard. What am I going to do with this?" And those workers who didn't have a drink for 3 weeks were saying, "Destroy it!" And I thought, you know, they are crazy, right? And he just opened those bottles and poured it to the ground. Yeah. Now, Hannah Arendt had this point about revolution, that suddenly, in the real revolutionary situation, you have completely different social dynamic, right? The councils, the different revolutionary forms emerging and so on, and this was that moment, right? So, you know, those workers who normally drink beer started to read poetry and were able to go without alcohol for a long time. So that was crazy, and this was Hannah Arendt's revolutionary moment. Now, when you think who was, there's this huge, of course, well-supported discussion, who did it, workers or intelligentsia in Poland? And this is very legitimate, of course, discussion. I think that the way I think about the middle class under socialist regime, I see those working class aristocrats working in the Gdańsk shipyard and making, you know, incredible amount of money as fully legitimate members of the middle class. And of course, the relationship between the opposition movement, intelligentsia, and those workers was very close. During that strike, there was this advising committee with Jadwiga Staniszkis and a couple of other Polish sociologists in the Gdańsk shipyard. So I think, right, this was not so clear-cut cut difference. All right.
So thank you.
I mean, not that you lose it, but it complicates the picture a little bit.
Can I resist one more thing? Adam Michnik, who is this father figure of the Polish dissident movement, when the strike started in Gdańsk shipyard, he just boarded the train, immediately was trying to get to the ship, and was caught by the secret police and arrested. And Adam says, well, this is the best thing which happened.